If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And if it ain't fixed, don't break it. Hey, it's Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a man who's gathering up a small team to defend a town from an unstoppable killing machine.
Mike DiCrisio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good, good. The recruiting's going well.
Is it?
Yeah, there's at least seven of us so far.
Right, and it's a very diverse seven, too. It's not yeah. You know, it's not just a bunch of white guys.
No, we wanted to check every box.
Yeah. if you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, first we start with some film news, and then we move on to some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately, and then after that, we'll move on into our featured review. This week we are reviewing the new film from director Antoine Fuqua, The Magnificent Seven, which is of course a remake of the 1960 Western The Magnificent Seven, directed by John Sturges, which is of course a remake of Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai, which is of course a remake of the immortal bard's Hamlet? No? All right.
Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, are you excited to talk Magnificent Seven?
I am, Mike. Yes.
Maggie Sev, as we say in the industry.
That's what the cool kids are calling it?
That's what the cool kids call it. Maggie Sev. Annie Fuchs, Maggie Sev.
All right, move on.
Yeah, before we get into that, let's get into some film news, Mike.
Hi! It's time for...
What?
It's time for film news, and before we start film news, I do want to say that we've been using a new film news theme song and a new discussions theme song for the past couple episodes, so credit to that goes to Kyle Cullen of the band Hollow Bones. If you want to check out his stuff, go ahead. Shout out to Kyle. He's been bugging me to shout him out for the past couple weeks.
you've just been using his stuff without crediting him.
Basically. And so yep. I apologize for that, but also he's been bugging me about this for a while. So there you go, Kyle Cullen. Created the theme songs for film news and discussions that we've been using for the past couple of weeks, the Eminem one and the reworked Usher theme for the discussion. So credit to him. Go check out Hollow Bones. Fun band. All right, let's get into some film news. So there's a couple of things I want to talk about in film news today, Mike. I guess the biggest news coming out from the past couple of days is that Jon Favreau, director of films like Iron Man, Iron Man 2, Cowboys and Aliens, Chef, and most recently, The Jungle Book, the live-action remake of the Disney classic, will be directing another live-action remake of a Disney classic featuring talking animals. He's going to be making a live-action version of The Lion King for Disney. And I don't know how to feel about this, Mike. Give me your thoughts. Do you think this is a good idea?
I thought The Jungle Book was way better than we were expecting, I think.
Sure.
So I trust him to recreate that. However, I don't remember there being humans in Lion King.
There are not. There are no humans in Lion King. Have you seen The Lion King recently, Mike? Any?
Not recently, though.
No. Okay. I saw it. I think the last time I saw it was when it was re-released in theaters, which was about 5 years ago.
Okay.
But it's one of my, like, it's a seminal film for me. I do enjoy The Lion King very much. It's like
one of those
classic Disney movies that hit right when I was becoming a child.
Right. Able to form long-term memories.
Exactly, yeah. Like, I watched The Lion King a lot when I was a kid. And I don't know how to feel about this. Like, The Jungle Book is one thing, right? Because The Jungle Book is a much older movie that can be updated and changed. And it's also based on a novel. It's based on a book, The Jungle Book.
Right.
This is just The Lion King. It's The Lion King's an original concept, quote unquote, because it's basically just Hamlet. But it's Hamlet with lions, you know, is basically the plot of The Lion King. But it's an original Disney movie. It's not like a readaptation of another work.
Right.
And so it's tough for me to see how this is going to work. I feel like I don't really need this.
No, that's definitely true. It definitely has the feel of being this worked before, let's make it with a more popular one and make more money.
Yeah, that's kind of how it feels like. And, like, I feel like Disney has been pretty solid about picking their live-action adaptations. They've been a pretty mixed bag, I think. Like, you know, you get your Alice in Wonderland, which is terrible. You got your Alice in Wonderland 2, which I didn't see, but is probably also terrible. You got, like, Maleficent, which I've heard okay things about. But, like, The Jungle Book was, like, the first one that really got stellar reviews out the gate.
Right. I know we just got, I think, trailer or some images from Beauty and the Beast also.
Beauty and the Beast does look very good. And that one, at least, you know, it has a human character at its center, and it's right. also based right. on a very well-known story that has been adapted many times and can be changed in, you know, a bunch of different yeah. things. I don't know if The Lion King is that kind of story. I would rather they just – I hope they just call it The Lion King, and it's actually just like a stage production of Hamlet.
I think
that would be amazing.
They just everyone's a human, and it's just like,
and they just call the characters like Simba and Timon and Pumbaa yeah. and stuff, but it's just Hamlet, like they're all speaking in old Shakespearean.
That would be amazing.
Like Simba has like a skull in his hand and he's like, alas, poor Scar. I knew him well.
I hope that's what happens.
there's no reason for that not to happen. Now that I've
exactly.
said it. So yeah, I don't know about this. This seems like weird. And I think John Favreau is also doing a sequel to The Jungle Book. So he's going to be spending a lot of time in the computer-generated talking animal Disney remake arena for the foreseeable future.
It's all right. He'll make billions of dollars.
It's a very specific niche.
You're right.
But yes, he will make billions of dollars. Yeah, I don't know about this. I don't know. Here's the thing. Jungle Book was pretty good, though.
Right. That's where I'm coming from. Is yeah. I enjoyed Jungle Book. I thought it looked really cool.
Yeah, and I like Jon Favreau. Like he's a solid director. And also, I will talk about this in discussions. But Peace Dragon, the other Disney remake from this year, was mm-hmm. very good. I actually like that movie quite a bit, and so I'll talk about that in a little bit. But the thing is, Jungle Book and Peace Dragon are like a different beast than The Lion King, right? Like The Lion King is right. a much more recent movie that people have very fond memories of. Jungle Book and Peace Dragon are a lot more malleable. Like they're older. You kind of revamp them and do different things with them, especially Peace Dragon, which is a movie that I feel like nobody really cared about that much.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I don't think I've ever heard of it before it came out again recently.
Really?
Yeah.
So fair enough. There you go.
Right. So yeah. You're right.
Yeah, but I'll talk about that in a little bit. So let's move on to some director news. There's a few things I want to talk about here. First of which is that Martin Scorsese's Silence will be released in December, which is kind of big news. This movie has been in the works for a very long time. I've been hearing about this movie since like 2010. Martin Scorsese has been attached to it for a long time, and it's always been like he's making it, but he's also making this other thing, and he's going to do that first. And he's eventually got forced into making this movie through like tax breaks or something. Like the producers of the movie were getting very angry at him for taking so long to make it because they had put a lot of money into it and it wasn't going anywhere. And so this movie is finally coming out. It's coming out in December too, which is pretty soon.
They got to get that Oscar qualifying run in.
Exactly, but I'm just excited that a new Martin Scorsese movie is coming out this year that I didn't think would be. So
right, that's true.
That is pretty cool, and that's stars Adam Driver, Andrew Garfield, and Liam Neeson. It's about two Jesuit priests in 17th century Japan who go to find their mentor. I'm looking forward to it.
What? That's the best thing I've ever heard. I'm so excited.
Yeah, so I'm very much looking forward to that. It should be pretty cool. And then another other director news, Duncan Jones, who recently directed Warcraft, and was also the director of movies like Moon and Source Code, has been working on this movie called Mute for a very long time. Much like Silence, I've been hearing about Mute pretty much since Moon came out, actually. He's been talking about Mute since like 2010, and he's talked about it as like sort of a sidequel to Moon. It's like in the same universe. I know Sam Rockwell is in the movie, but okay. he might be playing the same character he played in Moon. He might not be. Nobody's really sure. But it's finally getting made. It seems like after Warcraft, he was able to kind of scale back and do this like small scale, low budget project. And it's finally getting made, and it's going to be released through Netflix probably next year.
There we go.
That is very cool. I'm very excited about that. Duncan Jones is a director who I really, really like. I didn't get to see Warcraft, but I've heard pretty mixed to bad things about it.
Yeah, I watched it a couple days ago.
Did you?
Or last week. I did, yeah. Not so good. Not pretty dumb all around.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, because Moon is one of my favorite movies. So. Yeah.
But I think Mute is going to be Duncan Jones kind of working back in his wheelhouse and hopefully doing something on the scale of Moon, because that is just an incredible movie, and Mute is a really cool concept and a really cool idea, and I'm excited to see where it goes from here.
I think we're also going to move towards a almost exclusive original content Netflix in the near future. There was a new thing that came out, I think, a couple days ago, where they're library of movies has shrunk by 50% in the last couple years because now every other why would I pay to have Netflix stream my movie when I can make my own streaming service?
Yeah.
So every company is pulling their licenses out.
Yeah. So like NBC has their own app and CBS has their own app and like everybody has their own streaming app now. Right. Netflix isn't really seeing the point of paying more money for competitors' services. It seems like.
But luckily, Netflix is where it's at with all the original content so far. So I guess that's an interesting future we're going to live in.
They have been doing a solid job with original content. I don't know if I say their average is like great, but they constantly put out – like the thing is they're constantly putting out shows.
Right. Like, there's tons of stuff I've never seen before.
It seems like every week there's like a new show coming out on Netflix. Yeah. And it's always appealing to like a different niche of people. So it seems like every time – like every year there's like four or five new Netflix shows that are like great.
Right.
And even the ones that aren't like two thumbs up great appeal to a certain demographic that will really like it.
Right.
It's pretty genius, content branding on their part, which is pretty cool to see unfold. I don't know how sustainable that is because they are pouring so much money into these shows.
Yeah.
And they can't possibly be getting that money back. I have no idea.
I'm not really sure because that was always the draw of Netflix was all of your stuff was on this one site and you could go watch whatever TV show you wanted and everything. So we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting because they're pouring so much money into them. Like the Get Down cost like $150 million.
Right.
Like that's insane. Right. Like,
yeah, that's a blockbuster movie.
Yeah. So we'll see how that plays out in the near future. And then finally. Justin Lin, director of four of the seven Fast and Furious films, and also recently the director of Star Trek Beyond, has now attached to be directing a Hot Wheels movie. So I'm gonna let you make the obvious joke, Mike.
He's already made four of those.
Boom!
Got it.
So Justin Lin is directing a Hot Wheels movie. I don't know, man. I feel like Justin Lin keeps getting attached to worse projects. as his career goes on, which is weird. Like I after Star Trek Beyond, I was expecting like big things. Like, oh yeah, he can keep doing big blockbuster movies. And since then, he's gotten attached to Space Jam 2 and Hot Wheels, which are like
right.
I don't know, man. That's just not working out for me. I feel like you know he directed four Fast and Furious movies. He directed a Star Trek movie. He should be working on either something that he really wants to do. Or something that, you know, is big. Like something that's not a Hot Wheels movie. It just seems weird.
It seems weird. Hasbro must need money. Like, why are they licensing all these board games and toys? Like, I can't understand why we need a Hot Wheels movie.
Well, Hasbro is doing they got the Ouija movie coming out.
True. We got Battleship a couple years ago.
Right. But I mean, there's a Ouija 2 coming out is what I'm saying. Like, upcoming.
Saying, why is there a second one of those?
Thing is, I saw about a half hour of Ouija and it was not good. But the trailer for Ouija 2 looks great. I don't know if you've seen the trailer for Ouija 2.
I did actually.
That's directed by Mike Flanagan, who directed Hush. So I'm actually I'm tentatively excited about Ouija 2. We'll see what happens, but like it kind of looks good. but then they got the Transformers franchise, which is their big.
Oh, that's true. Yeah,
which we'll be having another installment next year, directed by Michael Bay. Transformers: The Last Night. Which have you seen the controversy surrounding Transformers: The Last Night? About the Nazi stuff. That they filmed a bunch of Nazi stuff in like Winston Churchill's home or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Like why? Why even do that?
But why not? Who cares? It's going to be dumb. Whatever. Yeah, it's going to be Transformers.
It seems like I realize like that's fine if you're going to do that in the movie, like as the plot of the movie. I feel like, from what I understand, I think it's going to have some kind of time travel element in it. It's called
sure.
Because I know that the King Arthur is a character in the movie. I know that one for a fact. What the fuck? It's called The Last Night.
That's true. You're right.
But so there could be like a lot of time travel wonkiness and like sure maybe like. England is taken over by the Nazis or something, like an alternate universe or something. Who knows? But to do it in real life, like, because they actually shot it in like Winston Churchill's home or something, and they draped it in like Nazi imagery.
Yeah, I did. I saw that.
Like that's, I don't know. That's a little crossing the line, you know.
That's too far for you, Mike.
Maybe not for me specifically, but I feel like people are going to be upset about that.
Oh yeah, okay, I see what you're saying.
Like there had to have been foresight for that, right? Like there had to have been somebody in the studio being like, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe we can shoot this anywhere else and just say it's Winston Churchill's home in the movie or something.
Yeah, but no press is bad press. No one
will know the difference, I guess.
So,
that happened, which is pretty weird. That's a little off topic. We're not.
It is a little bit. Oh, it's a Hasbro related movie.
It's all in the Hasbro cinematic universe.
Oh my god.
Anyway, so that's the director news. I wanted to bring that up, and then finally, there's two stories left. I wanted to bring this up real quick. There is the anthology TV series is becoming a big format these days with American Horror Story. You got True Detective. You got American Crime Story.
Fargo.
You got Fargo, a whole bunch of other stuff. A new anthology TV series is in the works in which every season will be remaking a different Alfred Hitchcock movie.
Sure, I guess.
I mean, this seems even more pointless than the Lion King remake to me.
Yeah, no, that's a good way to put it.
I mean, here's the thing. If it's, I think it would depend on the Alfred Hitchcock movie that they're going to go for. You know, if it's like a lesser known thing. Or if they decide to do, like, The Man Who Knew Too Much, a season-long thing, maybe that could be cool. But, like, the movies that they're talking about are, like, Psycho and The Birds.
A fucking course of it.
Which, if they do Psycho, I'm calling bullshit, because there's already a Psycho TV show on TV right now.
Oh, my God.
Right?
I didn't even put that together, but, yeah, there absolutely is.
Which I'm pretty sure that show is ending, but still, it's just ending.
Yeah.
Bates Motel is on TV. There's no point in doing a Psycho TV show.
No.
We're already doing it.
Yeah.
And the birds is just birds attacking people. That's the entire movie. That's not a 10-hour series.
No, it's not. I totally agree with you that I hope they get weird and do, you know, some lesser known stuff, or if they even go for birds or something, if they do one of the more well known things, they make it super, you know, like how Fargo is, and it's like about aliens also. Like, I don't know, make it super weird and cerebral.
Right.
Make it interesting rather than just doing a 10-episode, weird thriller thing. I don't know.
So Chris Columbus is directing the pilot of that, so we'll see how that transpires. I don't know if that'll even get past the production stage. Like, I feel like that won't make it to air. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. And then finally, last bit of film news, and the most important film news, really. Yorma Taccone, member of The Lonely Island and director of such films as Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping, and MacGruber, along with Will Forte, star of films such as MacGruber, are writing MacGruber 2. and I am very, very, very excited about this because I am a big fan of MacGruber. Mike, I don't know if you... have you seen MacGruber? Did I show this to you?
I have not seen MacGruber.
Man, you are missing out.
Somehow I missed being a good friend of yours for a long time and not seeing MacGruber.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened. But, yeah, I am a huge fan of MacGruber. I think it's one of the best Saturday Night movies out there. I think Will Forte is amazing in it. and it's a really incredible movie. That's an incredible cast of Will Forte, Kristen Wiig, Val Kilmer, Ryan Philippe, directed by Yorma Taccone from Lonely Island. The movie is shot very cinematically, and it's just a pretty perfect parody of action movies. Like, it's not really even a parody of MacGyver anymore. It's just a parody of action, like, 80, overblown 80s action movies.
Right.
But now that there's a new MacGyver TV show, I feel like there's never been a more perfect time.
For
MacGruber 2.
That's a really good point. We also have a Lethal Weapon TV show. This is the perfect time to come back and make fun of... we have no original thoughts. We need to remake everything from the 80s.
Yep.
Like you said. So this is perfect.
Exactly. Which is basically what 22 Jump Street is. But I think MacGruber 2 will find a new angle to tackle it. Yorma Taccone, I mean, I'm just a big fan of Lonely Island in general. But Yorma Taccone directed MacGruber, and then he directed Pop Star, Never Stop, Never Stopping. Both of those movies were disastrous box office bombs. But they are also two of the best comedies of the last several years. So really, it's the people who are wrong. It's the audiences who don't understand.
Right.
I'm very excited about this. I think this is going to be really cool. I don't know if this will get a theatrical release or if who's going to finance this. Basically, it's just them writing the scripts. Yorma Taccone tweeted like a picture of him and Will Forte writing the script and said like it's a super rough draft. So it might be a while until this happens, but the important thing is it could be happening. So very excited about that.
And as we said, in the Netflix future, anything is possible.
That's true. I think that's a perfect candidate for straight to Netflix movie. But, we'll see. I would like it to be in theaters because the first one was. And, like Anchorman 2 made it to theaters.
Shots fired.
I mean, but Anchorman was a huge hit, so
right, yeah.
So there's that. But in any case, let's move on to our discussions, Mike. Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're gonna talk about movies for our discussions. All right, it's time for our discussions. Mike, what do you got to discuss today?
So today I got two things to discuss. The first one is Macbeth, which came out last year. It stars Michael Fassbender, Marion Cotillard, and directed by Justin Kurzel.
I believe you mean the Scottish play, but continue.
Okay, I'm not in the theater, so so I'm not cursed. It's fine. But yes, that one. This came out last year. So this is one of the most visually stunning movies I've seen in a long time. It opens with a big, you know, medieval sword fight battle between two armies, and it's filmed all in with high-speed cameras. So it's in the super awesome slow-mo, and it's raining, and there's fog, and it looks really badass, and is a really interesting way to open this type of play, or movie, story. It is written to keep the original language from the play, so that's cool if you're into that type of thing. And it's also made to be super, not gritty, but gross. Like it's raining the whole movie. They're in a mud hut village for the whole most of the whole runtime. Everyone's dirty and scarred and gross.
Right.
So it makes it super visceral for what's going on. But you know, the plot of Macbeth is revenge murder and all this crazy stuff. Marion Cotillard is one of the best Lady Macbeths I've ever seen, and it's kind of like almost one of those situations where, like, yeah, of course she's Lady Macbeth. I don't. It's when you see Marion Cotillard in this role, it's one of those things. And there's more people in it. David Thewlis and Patty Considine are in it, which is I didn't know anyone else was in it besides Michael Fassbender and Marion Cotillard. So that was cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think people should check it out, especially as a precursor to Assassin's Creed, which is Michael Fassbender and Justin Kurzel again teaming up.
And Marion Cotillard, I believe, is in that movie too.
I think she might be. You're right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's pretty cool. Yeah. Except Michael Fassbender was making Assassin's Creed for a while. Like he's attached to it for a long time. And then he did this Macbeth movie, and he got the guy from Macbeth to jump on.
To come along.
So that's pretty cool. He's making his blockbuster debut. I'm hoping for big things out of that movie.
Yeah, this Macbeth gave me a lot of confidence for Assassin's Creed. So hopefully it breaks the curse of video game movies.
Yeah, I had hopes that Warcraft was going to be that movie, but...
Yeah. Although it is interesting, from what I've heard about Assassin's Creed, that they are adapting an original story within the universe. They're not trying to remake one of the video games. So that should allow them to make a good one, in question mark.
Hopefully. Yeah. We'll
hopefully.
See. Yeah. Since you had watched Warcraft the other day, do you want to talk about that too? Well, just a brief.
Yeah, sure. That was a pretty dumb movie, which is unfortunate. I had a lot of high hopes for that before it came out. But it felt a lot like this whole first movie could have been the opening crawl of a better movie.
Okay.
It sets up a ton of stuff that doesn't resolve because, like, clearly there's going to be way more. But in the, like, this is the first act prequel way of setup. Like, this is the starting of the main conflict for the rest of the story. And
right.
It just made the movie feel pointless because it was just setting up other things and nothing happened. Paula Patton looks ridiculous because she looks awesome in the practical makeup as a half-orc, but all she does is serve to be the human in front of the green screen that is the other orcs. So that was a terrible choice. Also, it's pretty clearly just so they can have a hot woman in furs. That's my brief thoughts on Warcraft. They could have made a better one, I think. Maybe, I don't know.
Okay.
If they had chosen a different starting point for the story.
Yeah.
So then the other thing I wanted to discuss, I'll do it briefly also, was Luke Cage just came out, I think last week. I don't remember the exact date.
I believe September, like a couple days ago, September 30th.
September 30th, right. New Marvel movie, part of the Defender... Or
TV
Marvel,
show.
Marvel TV show, excuse me.
Yep.
Part of the whole Defenders, you know, saga they're starting or doing in the middle of on Netflix with Daredevil, Jessica Jones. I'm sure everyone already knows everything.
Yeah, I saw Luke Cage come out, and I was like, all right, how quickly can Mike watch this? Because every time this new Marvel TV show, you have watched it by the time that we start the next podcast.
Yep, and I did it again.
Yeah, so good job. Keep the brand alive.
That's right.
But so what? Go to your overall thoughts on Luke Cage, man. What's the skinny?
Luke Cage, it didn't grab me as hard as Jessica Jones did, but I think that's more Jessica Jones as a straight ahead like noir, which is we've talked about as like my jam. However, this movie this show, I was really involved in. I thought it was awesome. I liked we're finally getting to the thing that I talked about in Daredevil season 2, so a little bit also like the team is coming together in some way. The other people, the other heroes aren't in this one. But it's much more, we're not in the same 10 block neighborhood. We're not in Hell's Kitchen. We've moved uptown to Harlem. we're building this world a little bit.
Right.
And there is references and context to the things that are happening in the other shows, which is nice because we're finally, it's no more like wink, wink, nudge, nudge. There's other heroes. Like we refer to the people by name now, which is nice.
You refer to the people in the TV shows by name. By the movies, it's still like the big green guy and the guy with the hammer, right?
That's unfortunately that is a thing. The incident. They do say Iron Man and Captain America. They do say those names. They do, but not in reference to those people. It's really weird.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, like it's odd.
Okay.
But that said, this is a show that is firmly and strongly about blackness and masculinity and what the streets mean and respect, and it's going head on against police brutality and racism and all of those things like that are coming up in our culture all the time now. And I strongly applaud this show for just going like balls to the wall and like not holding anything back. The fact that Luke Cage is constantly wearing a hoodie that is riddled with bullet holes, direct connection to Trayvon Martin.
Right.
And you know, all of these things, and it's not pulling any punches, and it's really awesome to see that kind of thing. And hopefully they continue that with Black Panther. I know the Marvel TV and Marvel movies are different teams, but I hope they keep that same attitude and that same fierceness towards what they're going for. So I have really, we've already had really high hopes for Black Panther, but I think this shows what they can do. So hopefully they do it in that movie as well. It feels a little long at 13 episodes. There's a weird...
I have felt that every Marvel Netflix series feels a little long at 13 episodes.
I feel like they could really benefit from being 10 or 8 episodes.
Yeah, I think like Daredevil especially, not only did the season feel long, but I feel like every episode feels like it could be like 5 or 10 minutes shorter. and not even just the episodes, but like individual, like you can tell when like individual scenes in Daredevil go on too long. Like it's actually like really
the camera
bad.
Just hangs there at the end of the scene.
Yeah, or like the conversation continues like 3 minutes past its logical endpoint.
Right.
Like it could cut to the next thing. There's a lot of unnecessary information they try to convey. It could just go forward.
I feel like they sort of avoid that in terms of like the scene to scene thing, but the actual arc and the story kind of loops a little bit, and then we get like the last 4 episodes. So I don't know. It felt like if they could have trimmed it to 10 or 8 or something like that, it would have been much more powerful. Just Method Man is in an episode, which is really cool. That just popped into my head. but there is a lot of things like that, references to hip hop and black culture and black literature, because it takes place in Harlem and you know about the Jazz Age and the Harlem Renaissance and the role of art in that neighborhood's reputation and everything. So it's really cool and interesting. And there's also a lot of literature, like they constantly talk about all the black private detectives, like written by Walter Mosley and Chester Hines and stuff like that. So it is right up my alley also, nice. Just like Jessica Jones is. So it is really cool. People, I'm sure, will check it out.
Yeah, very cool. I'd like to check that out soon. I probably will once I finish up Twin Peaks, which, by the way, I'm about halfway through season 2 of Twin Peaks. I'm still enjoying it.
Congratulations.
I'm past the Laura Palmer stuff. Like, her killer has been found. And I'm past that. And I'm now in the part of the show where people tell me it gets bad. so far, I'm still enjoying it. David Duchovny just showed up, which has been enjoyable. So I'm really enjoying it. But speaking of Luke Cage, how Like, how does Luke Cage as a character compare to his character in Jessica Jones? Because he was a recurring character on that show for about 6 or 7 episodes. So is it like is it consistent with his portrayal there? And is it like does he get a lot
yes.
more? I mean, I assume he gets a lot more to do in the show than he does in Jessica Jones.
Right.
But he was a pretty significant part of that show, too.
He is, yeah. And a lot of that the thumb drive stuff from Jessica, right? I believe that was in Jessica Jones, right?
Maybe.
I assume. Where they're trying to find a thumb drive that has the history, whatever. Stuff's on a thumb drive, okay. Basically. the great plot point of the early 2000s is find the thumb drive. and that's in this show. But yeah, I haven't rewatched Jessica Jones, so I don't remember exactly what happens with his character and how he leaves the show.
From what I remember, and I guess spoilers for Jessica Jones, he comes under Kilgrave's spell towards the end.
Right.
Kilgrave takes control over him. He and Jessica Jones fight, and Luke Cage gets, I think, badly hurt.
Yeah, right? She like shoots him with a shotgun or something, right?
Something along those lines. She somehow hurts him, even though he is bulletproof.
Yes.
Somehow incapacitates Luke Cage, and then he spends the last episode recuperating in her room with Claire Temple like watching over him.
Right.
And
okay.
Then
yeah.
Cuts back, and then he's like disappeared. He's gone.
And he's gone. Right. Right. Yeah. I forgot about that. That is directly involved. Claire comes back. She's the one connecting character so far for all the shows. She's the one that's popped up in all of them.
Yep.
So she's there, which is awesome because Rosario Dawson is great.
Right.
And she has a very big role in this show. She's in way more episodes than I think she was in the other shows.
Really? I remember she had a pretty big role in season 1 of Daredevil, I feel.
Yeah.
Like. But I remember she's season 2, that was like scaled back pretty significantly.
Right. It might be on par with season 1.
Okay.
And there is some question maybe about timeline, about are these all happening concurrently? Because they like reference stuff that's going on in Hell's Kitchen rather than stuff that happened. So that was a thing I was a little fuzzy on. But he is given, you know, way more care. We learn his origin, his whole backstory. We learn what his powers are precisely and things. And it does reference Hell's Kitchen multiple times, which is really funny. There's one guy shows up in Harlem and crazy shootout happens, and he's like, "That's it, I'm going back to Hell's Kitchen where it's safe." And he like leaves, which is really, really funny.
Nice.
So people will check it out, I'm sure.
Yeah. All right, so that's Luke Cage, and as well as Warcraft and Macbeth. And then from my discussions, you actually had a lot of discussions this time. That could be. For my discussions. I got a couple movies and a TV show to talk about. The first movie is called Sing Street, which is the new movie from director John Carney. He was the director of Once a few years ago. And since Once came out, he's been kind of been hit or miss. He came out with a movie called Begin Again a few years ago with Keira Knightley and Mark Ruffalo. They got pretty mixed reviews. But Sing Street is fantastic. It is really fantastic. It is a coming-of-age story about a group of kids in Ireland in the 1980s who form a band together. The music is amazing. The relationships feel very authentic. It's just all around very damn good. I felt very nice coming out of this movie. It's really good, really effective, and the music is so good. Like a lot of it's original songs. There's some covers, but a lot of it's original songs, and it's just a lot of fun to watch. So big fan of Sing Street. If you're a fan of musicals, if you're a fan of just coming of age like stories about kids, highly recommended. Sing Street's very good. And then I also saw Pete's Dragon, which is the other Disney remake that came out this year, and it kind of flew under the radar, I feel like. You know, the Jungle Book kind of was the big one, like that was kind of the big blockbuster one, and Pete's Dragon kind of underperformed at the box office, mostly because nobody really cares about Pete's Dragon that much.
Yeah, like I said, I don't think I've ever heard of that, besides... Yeah.
Well, the original Pete's Dragon, if you're unfamiliar, was the live-action Disney movie that integrated animated characters into it. So it was a live-action movie that had an animated dragon, like a 2D animated dragon. It was kind of like a precursor to Who Framed Roger Rabbit before that technology was good. And so this is a remake of that movie. It's directed by David Lowery, who is the director of Ain't Them Body Saints, which is it seems like an odd marriage of director and material here, but it actually works out very well. This is a really enjoyable Disney remake. That evokes a very specific time and place, this like 70s set logging town in like the Northeast. And it has this very kind of old fashioned charm. It's like kind of a throwback almost to like the family friendly films of old. Stars Bryce Dallas Howard, Carl Urban, Wes Bentley, and Robert Redford. And Robert Redford in this movie, just like watching him gaze in wonder at the dragon, is just a sight to behold. He is doing full on Spielberg face, and it's great. So it's very good, and the dragon looks great. Like it looks like the CG to create the dragon looks very impressive. The kids at the center of the movie are very good. It's just overall very enjoyable. I have a feel good discussions for this.
Yes, you do.
for this time around, Sing Street.
You managed to escape. You escaped the Snyderverse for a while.
Yeah, but of course now we're back in the Snyderverse, and now that I've finished talking about them, we're all just living in the Snyderverse.
That's right.
And then finally, the last thing I wanted to talk about is this TV show which premiered in June. I guess it's more of a web series, depending on your definition of these things. It's called Harmon Quest, which is a series on CISO, which is a streaming service that I recently subscribed to. CISO is the streaming app for NBC, or it's NBC helped produce it anyway. It's got a lot of original content on there, and it's mostly geared towards comedy geeks. It's actually entirely geared towards comedy geeks. Every show on there is like from some kind of like comedy creator. Right now is Harmon Quest, which is from creator Dan Harmon, creator of Community and Rick and Morty. There's Bajillion Dollar Properties, which is created by Kulap Vlasak and produced by Scott Aukerman. You've got Debate Wars, which is hosted by Michael Ian Black. And then you've got a bunch of different comedy specials, and there's the back catalogs of NBC shows like 30 Rock and Parks and Recreation and Saturday Night Live. The entire back catalog of Saturday Night Live is on there, which is pretty big.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and they've also got the entire back catalog of like Monty Python's Flying Circus, and like every Monty Python thing is on there too. A lot of British TV is on there as well. Like a lot of like older BBC comedy shows are on there. So it's a pretty big, cool thing for comedy fans, and it's only $3.99 a month, which is kind of the most insane thing. It's only $4. Pretty cool. Anyway, I started watching the show Harmon Quest. If you're familiar with Harmon Town, which is Dan Harmon's podcast, then you'll know that on that podcast, they play Dungeons and Dragons from time to time. Do they still do that in Harmon Town? That's kind of scaled back, right?
Well, they had switched to another RPG called Shadowrun, which is like a cyberpunk version of Dungeons and Dragons, and then they started making the joke that they were contractually obligated to only play 10 minutes of RPG, and like it's a weird, people are not sure if that was a running gag because they didn't want to do it anymore, or because of Harmon Quest they weren't allowed to do it anymore.
Maybe.
So they haven't done it in a couple months, in a while.
Okay, yeah, I have not listened to Harmon Town in a while, but I did used to listen to it when it first started like coming out. But if you're a fan of the D&D on Harmon Town, you're going to enjoy the show. Like it's basically exactly that. The story is scripted. Like it's kind of a scripted story, but all the dialogue is improvised, and it's just a really fun show to see these comedians just hanging out together and playing Dungeons and Dragons. There's a new guest star every episode, which includes Paul F. Tompkins in the first episode. Kumail Nanjiani is in an episode. Aubrey Plaza, Steve Agee. The last episode has Matt Gourley of the I Was There Too podcast, I know we're both big fans of. And the rest of the cast is Dan Harmon, Jeff Davis from Whose Line Is It Anyway, Erin McGaffey, who is Dan Harmon's wife, not anymore.
At the time,
she was his wife, and Spencer Crittenden, who is the game master. And the story for Spencer is like crazy, because I remember hearing that podcast when they like first discovered him. Right. He was just there in the audience. When they decided, they were like kind of just saying, like, "Oh, it'd be cool if we play Dungeons and Dragons or something," but we need a dungeon master. And then Spencer like raised his hand, like, "I'm a dungeon master," and they just brought him on stage. And now he's like their personal like friend and acquaintance, and like he works with them all the time. Like,
he co-created what was it? They did a show on History Channel that I can't remember.
Great Minds with Dan Harmon.
Great Minds, yeah.
Which I've seen bits of. I've been meaning to catch up on that as well.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Yeah, but yeah, this show, very good. I'm hoping there's a season two. I hope a season two happens. I'm not sure of its status due to Dan Harmon and Erin McGaffey splitting up. They were married, and now they're not anymore. And so who knows what will happen. If there's season two, maybe Erin McGaffey will sit out and somebody else will join in. But in any case, really, really enjoyable show. Jeff Davis is like MVP for me. I think everything he does was hilarious. I feel like he found the most inventive ways to play the game. Like I don't play Dungeons and Dragons really. Like I've played it a little bit, but not to the extent that someone like you has.
Right.
But if I were to play the game like on a regular basis, I feel like I would do it like Jeff Davis does in this show.
Okay.
Like kind of fucking around, but also going towards the goal that they're all going towards.
Yeah.
So anyway, in any case, Harmon Quest, I'm a big fan of. The entire season one is on CISO. And CISO is worth checking out. It's definitely a cool streaming service. I will say that I had difficulties getting it because I was trying to get it on my TV, which you can only really, like, to get it on through my PS4, you have to do it through Amazon Prime. Now, I have Amazon Prime, so that wasn't a problem. But I was thinking, I was just on my computer, and I was like, oh, I'll subscribe to CISO, and then I'll connect it to my Amazon Prime account so I can, you know, do that. You can't do that. You have to subscribe to it through Amazon Prime. So, okay. So luckily it's like a free, like when you sign up, it's like a free trial. So I didn't get charged twice, but I subscribed to it on the computer, on CISO.com. I subscribed and I actually put in like a promo code. So I got 2 free months on the computer.
Nice.
And then I tried to connect it to my Amazon Prime account and it wouldn't let me.
That's bizarre.
I had to start a free trial on Amazon Prime. And so, I'm going with the Amazon Prime account, which only gave me a 7-day free trial, by the way.
Even though you have 2 free months.
Exactly. Like, that's insane. So I'm going with the Amazon Prime account just because I want to be able to watch it on my TV.
Right. That will be the death of any streaming service for any of these other channels that are popping up now. If it's difficult to get the thing that I paid for or difficult to get to your content, I'm just going to pirate it and make it easy because... Like that's why piracy is a thing, because you make it hard for me to get this thing that I want.
Yeah.
So that's pretty insane that you can't like just link the accounts, or you can't, they don't have an app. Like you need to go through this other app.
It is a bit of a bummer, but but CISO is, I think, worth it. There's a lot of cool stuff on there. While we're on the subject, I think the Amazon Prime interface is pretty terrible. Like, I don't know. Do you have Amazon Prime, Mike? I feel like you do, right?
I used to, yeah. I had it when I had the student rate, okay. But that's only good for a certain number of years, I think 3 or 4. So I don't have it anymore right now. But
okay, the Amazon Prime account, like app is very difficult to navigate. I feel like, and like I still use it, and like it has all the content I want. Like if I really want something, I just search for it. But like to actually like browse through things, I find very difficult. It's not like Netflix. Even Netflix, I don't think is a great interface. You know what has a great interface? HBO. HBO Go has a great interface because everything is alphabetical order. It's the best. Anytime I want to find anything on HBO Go, it's right there. I can easily find it. On Netflix, it's kind of like what Netflix wants you to watch. And so you see the same things over and over again. But at least you have an idea of what's there. Amazon Prime is kind of like a shit show. Like I have no idea what I'm going to see at any given moment on Amazon Prime. And then if I go to click through stuff, I'll click on a section and then it'll bring me to a bunch of subsections. And then I'll click on a subsection and it might bring me to more subsections, or it'll show me things. Or if I click on a thing in that subsection and then I decide to go back, it'll bring me back all the way back to the homepage. And I had to it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. There's a lot of good content on Amazon Prime, which is why like I'm happy with it. I'm keeping it. But the interface for the app is really, really rough. But in any case, Harmon Quest is very good.
Oh, right. We were doing a thing.
But anyway, I think that about wraps up our discussions, Mike. And also a slight rant about user interfaces on apps, which everybody is very fascinated by.
Yep. Tune in next week for the user interface cast.
but we'll get to that later. Right now, let's get into our featured review, Mike. This week, we are reviewing The Magnificent Seven.
Man carries a gun, he tends to use it.
Dan, you dead? Pity.
I had just ordered a drink from that man.
Took a job, looking for some men to join.
Is it difficult? Impossible.
How many you got so far?
You and me.
Who's she?
We work for her.
Good Lord.
That's right.
That man murdered my husband.
I want something. I take it.
He will take everything we have.
So you seek revenge?
I seek righteousness. but I'll take revenge.
All right, that was from the trailer for The Magnificent Seven, written by Nick Pizzolatto and Richard Wenk, and directed by Antoine Fuqua. The movie stars Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, Vincent D'Onofrio, Byung-Hun Lee, Manuel Garcia-Rulfo, Martin Sensmeyer, Haley Bennett, and Peter Sarsgaard, among others. The IMDb plot synopsis of this movie reads, seven gunmen in the Old West gradually come together to help a poor village against savage thieves. So, Mike, have you seen the original Magnificent Seven?
I have seen it before, but I don't remember. I know I've seen it, but it was a long time ago, and I don't really remember much about it. Okay. So
yeah, I watched it.
Effectively, no, I guess.
I watched it a couple years ago, and it's a movie that I very much like. Like it's good, but it also kind of seems like a very fine candidate for a remake. You know, it's a very basic story that can kind of be shifted into whatever it is you want it to be. So with some thought, I think it could be updated in like a really interesting way. And I think casting Denzel in the lead of this movie and going for a more diverse cast is a start. And I think that's a very good place to like kind of lead the movie around. Like this is the new Magnificent Seven with like this new diverse, interesting cast. I don't think it does really anything more than that to kind of justify its own existence.
Right.
But to that end, I thought it was pretty solid fun. Like I enjoyed it. I don't know. What about you?
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I thought it was actually a lot of fun. It's like you said, it's a fairly simple, straightforward plot that we've probably seen variations on forever. And I thought it was cool. It does a lot of not new things, and it seems to revel in using the old Western cliches. There's a couple times where I think like to a joke, like, you know, as a used as a joke, like guy goes in the door of a saloon, you hear a punch and he comes out the window, like right. Silly, like silly stuff that happens in Blazing Saddles, like type of thing, which is fun. Those kind of things are silly and fun. And it's not a grim, dark. Well, this is a dark story and movie. There are, you know, dark moments and things.
Right.
It has fun with what this plot is, which was cool. I enjoyed that. It wasn't. We weren't grumpy about the fact that we're superheroes. We're kind of excited to use justice and stuff, and it was fun.
I felt like every actor in this movie, their only direction was, you are the coolest person who has ever existed.
And that's go
with
accurate.
That. Run with that.
Do that thing.
Yeah. As a fan of Westerns, I'm pretty happy with just some cool action scenes and performances in which every actor seems to think they're the coolest person ever. Like,
yeah, like that's what a Western movie is.
So to that end, I think it's solid. I don't think it does anything more than that. It doesn't transcend the right. Western genre, which I think it kind of had the potential to, and I feel like it didn't quite get there. But all the performances in this movie are just a heck of a lot of fun. I mean, Chris Pratt just slips so easily into Steve McQueen's like cool guy role.
Yeah. Yep. The only thing I'm nervous is hopefully that's not his only thing though. Cool guy in a vest. Because so far,
I think we're gonna. Did you see the trailer for Passengers when you saw Magnificent Seven?
I did. Yeah.
I think we're gonna see a different side of Chris Pratt in that movie than we have in the past couple of films. Like, what's he made lately? Guardians of the Galaxy, Jurassic World, and this. Like, that's been pretty much it. All kind of variations on the same hero archetype.
Right.
I can sort of see where you're coming from, but at the same time, like, he's really good at it.
He is. Yeah, that's not to knock him.
Yeah, he comes off a lot better here than I think he does in Jurassic World.
Yes.
So there's that, at least. Not to throw Jurassic World under the bus again.
But that type of character fits this movie better than it does.
The thing is, that character can work in Jurassic World. I just feel like I remember thinking he kind of felt very stiff in that movie, whereas in this he feels a little more loose. Which, like, he would almost have to, like, in this kind of setting. It kind of feels like a mix of his characters from Jurassic World and Guardians of the Galaxy, almost. Like, he's definitely a lot cooler than Peter Quill is.
Right.
And he's not as stiff as his character in Jurassic World, so it's kind of like a mixture of the two.
Yeah, he's as cool as Peter Quill thinks he is.
That is exactly right.
That's what he is.
And there are even moments where it's like, man, this feels exactly like Chris Pratt in Parks and Rec. Like, like in this, which is exactly what I want. Like as much fun as Chris Pratt is as an action star, I'd really just like him to go back to be in comedies again. Like, you know, like when will he be seventh billed on a sitcom on NBC again? You know, that's what I want. But he's great. He's great in this movie. Also, Byung-Hun Lee and Martin Sensmeyer are suitably badass as Billy Rocks from Red Harvest. I thought those two very, very much stood out to me. Vincent D'Onofrio doing a ridiculous voice.
Yeah, but it fits. So did you said you watched Magnificent Seven years ago, right?
That
you
haven't a couple seen years recently? Ago, like 2 or 3 years ago, probably.
Okay, so a couple of days before I went to see this, I rewatched Seven Samurai.
Did you?
Just as a experiment to see what, you know, see what the differences are and things.
Yeah.
And the character that he's supposed to be, or Vincent D'Onofrio's character from Seven Samurai is just like as cartoonish as he is as Vincent D'Onofrio is. The character in Seven Samurai is just a like straight buffoon character. Like, it's so silly and is hilarious.
Yeah.
So it was funny to see like what that translates to 2016 Western, like what that that type of character is. And like the voice was the least silly thing like he could have done.
Yeah, I kind of enjoyed the voice. Like, D'Onofrio is like a very weird performer, I feel like. And I feel like in a lot of his mainstream roles, people don't get that.
Right.
You know, like he's great in like Daredevil. Like, he's very menacing in Daredevil.
Yeah.
But I saw this movie with, people who really only know D'Onofrio through Daredevil.
Okay.
And so, you know, they were pretty, I think my friend was pretty excited to see him in this movie. And then as soon as he started talking, he was like, I'm talking like this. This is Vincent D'Onofrio's voice in the movie. And my friend was like, what? Is happening. But like, D'Onofrio's kind of a weird performer. Like, his performance in Men in Black, for example, is like a very bizarre, weird performance. Like, it's mostly like he's an alien bug trapped in a human's body, and he's doing like these very weird facial movements and like sounds like throughout the movie. And that's kind of in his wheelhouse. So I think it's another in a long line of weird D'Onofrio performances that are pretty enjoyable to watch. I also think the movie looks incredible. Like, the cinematography of this movie is amazing. And I think Westerns as a genre, like in general, kind of lend themselves to great cinematography. Like, they have great opportunities to have like lush landscapes and unique lighting. But even among the genre, I think this stands out. There's a shot of like a silhouetted Denzel Washington against the night sky. That is just like incredible. Like, really blew me away. What did you think of Denzel in this movie, Mike?
He's the baddest motherfucker on earth in this whole movie. Yeah. Like everyone else from this cast.
Yeah, he really anchors this movie. Like, he is the heart and soul of this thing. And yeah, he's great. He's awesome. I'd also argue that he and Ethan Hawke are kind of the only members who really get their own arc.
Yes. I would agree with that.
Which to me is kind of a drawback for those other characters. Like, they're almost a little bit underwritten. But they, like, at least these guys get some pretty satisfying arcs, especially Denzel. Ethan Hawke is more off to the side, but it's kind of like a subtle thing that kind of comes back in a big way towards the end, which I really liked. I think Denzel's arc in this movie is pretty solid throughout. Most members of the Seven do get their moments to shine, which I liked. The only one who kind of gets overshadowed to me is Manuel Garcia Rulfo as Vasquez, the Mexican outlaw.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel like I kind of lost him in the shuffle. Like, I didn't really remember him that much by the end of the movie.
Yeah, I would agree. And it was interesting too. I guess we'll talk about maybe in spoilers and stuff to see, you know, the differences. Seven Samurai is very much about what it means to be a samurai and honor and, you know, your duty and things like that and justice. And this movie touches on that, and it is about those things. But it is interesting to see how the resolution of Denzel's character's arc affects what you thought, affects how justice and honor and duty and things were perceived through this world. So I guess we'll get into that in spoilers also.
Right.
But yeah, I agree. Him and Ethan Hawke are pretty much the only ones that have any kind of characterization or backstory. Other than being a hard-drinking, quick-shooting person. That's what everyone else is.
Right. What did you think of Peter Sarsgaard as the villain?
It seemed like his only direction was be the most evil person you could be.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was fine. But also, he's never really given like an opportunity to have like an iconic villain scene or anything like that. The movie spends most of its focus on the heroes.
Right? Yeah, and this movie does seem to, like I said, it kind of revels in the Western cliches with the The other one that I thought of too was the guy gets shot and falls into the coffin, like
right,
which I think also happens in Blazing Saddles. but it does seem to lean on some tropes for the Western genre, which they kind of all you know, they all do in some weird way. Where I feel like that's what the Peter Sarsgaard's character is just be the evil prospector guy who's gonna kill the whole town, kind of thing. But and we don't really get a chance to learn why he like looks like he's a junkie the whole movie. Like he's always like super sweaty and like twitchy. Yeah. And, like it looks like he would be on coke or something, but I don't know if that was a thing. Right. So yeah, I don't know. That's just my thoughts on his character. He was effective. He serves as a impetus for the whole story. So
yes,
it worked.
Yeah. All right. And then also I did want to mention this movie is super violent.
Yeah, it is actually
more than I was expecting, and this was I was surprised that this was rated PG-13 after I saw it, because like it's if there was like blood in this movie, because there's not really like it's like bloodless gun violence, which is why I got
it's PG-13 violence.
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, like if there was any like amount of blood in this movie, it would have been rated R. Like I think easily, hopefully, you know. But I did like the violence. Like I'm a big fan of just fantasy movie violence, and so it was enjoyable to watch. Yeah. And it has some great action scenes. I think the action scene, especially I think the set piece when they first enter the town and take out like 30 guys by themselves, I thought that was very well executed and very well done. And Nick Pizzolatto writes the script for this movie. Nick Pizzolatto is the creator of True Detective,
right?
And I think this film does include his penchant for over dialogue, I guess you could say. Like dialogue beyond the dialogue.
What if his dialogue, in fact, prefigured the dialogue?
Yeah, dialogue—the kind of dialogue that could be said in 4 words, but instead is said in 40.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think it has a kind of a lyrical quality to it that helps the movie out a little bit, puts the movie in its favor, and it kind of—I think he has a lot of fun writing quips for you know, Chris Pratt and Ethan Hawke and all of them. So in general, I think this movie is solid fun, right?
Yes.
You know, it doesn't do much new with the original concept outside of diversify the cast, because the original movie is all white guys.
Of course it is.
It was a Western in the 1960s. Like
that's what I mean. Yeah.
It was 7 white guys, an entire town of white guys. It's not a woman who finds them either in the movie. It's like the town leaders who like recruit them.
Right.
It's like 7 white guys fighting a Mexican villain.
Of course. God damn it.
Which, by the way, like, you know, Eli Wallach as the villain in that movie is phenomenal. Like, he's great. But that's, you know, besides the point. So this movie does diversify the cast, which is a great start to do something new with it. But it feels like it could have done a lot more about it. It just kind of follows the exact same story as the original movie, just with a diverse cast. And on the one hand, I kind of feel like that's sort of the idea. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like the idea behind making this movie is that, you know, it's not making race an issue. Like, it's just like, oh, yeah, these guys are, like, the 7 people who save the town, and it's not a big deal. But at the same time, I feel like if you, like, subtly introduce those elements into the movie and kind of make it sort of about that, it might have made for a stronger story.
Right.
You know, because at this time, like, in the 1870s or whatever, it was like a pretty racist time. Right.
Yeah, I mean, there is hints of that when we were first introduced to Denzel Washington's character.
Right.
When he rolls into that first town, I don't remember. That type of thing does happen. They do, you know, throw out some epithets, whatever the word is, I can't think of right now. Excuse me. But yeah, it doesn't really go much further than that, and I feel like it sort of undercuts its own message about was his name Red Harvest? Was that the
character? Red Harvest was the Indian character, yeah.
Yeah, the Native American character there. No one in the Magnificent Seven at that point, or Magnificent Six at that point, I guess, mentions the fact that Denzel Washington's character is black. It's a total non-issue, but they are all super racist against the Native American. And, like, it's, like, super undercuts its own story there.
Yeah, no, I could see where you're coming from there, yeah. It's almost like... Like, as much as I enjoyed the movie, it's also like kind of like what was the point of remaking The Magnificent Seven, aside from just making the same movie with new actors, right? Like,
yeah,
I feel like if you're gonna remake something, It should be like an updated version of that story, like a newer version that can do something different with it for today's time period. I think one of the best examples of a remake that I can think of is probably Ocean's 11. You know, that's
right.
Like taking this much older movie from like 1960 and kind of updating it with modern slick camera techniques and like doing different things with it. And like having, it's basically not even the same movie. It's just like, it's just like different famous, it's different famous people doing a different kind of heist and doing a different kind of thing. And I think it is very effective. Or Pete's Dragon, which I was talking about earlier, you know, it's an updated version of that 1973 Pete's Dragon movie. It's not, you know, a 2D animated dragon that's goofily singing songs. It's, I know you're laughing because I made motions when I did that, but still.
That's right, sure.
I want to make sure the people listening in get that I made motions of the dragon singing songs.
Let's explain this visual gag. Hold on.
And there's not that in Peace Dragon. I feel like this, you know, doesn't update the original movie enough to really warrant its own existence.
Right.
But at the same time, it's solid fun. Like it's an enjoyable time. It's a well produced, well made Western. It looks awesome. A lot of fun gunfights. A lot of fun performances. So yeah. I would give it a solid recommendation. Like it's,
I would, yeah. It's a good go time. See it. The you know matinee or first showing price. it's a fun action movie basically.
Yeah.
With cool stuff happening.
Does a solid job. It'll wet your crisp Pratt whistle until Passengers comes out.
Exactly.
And until Guardians of the Galaxy 2 comes out, if you choose to pass on Passengers. Although Passengers looks pretty good. I don't know if you've seen the... I mean, you saw the trailer, but I've heard very good things about that script, and it looks like a really cool concept. So I'm all in on Passengers. But enough about Passengers. Let's talk about more Magnificent Seven when we get to spoilers, starting right now. So spoilers for Magnificent Seven starting right now. First things first, I was very happy to hear a reworked version of the classic Magnificent Seven theme over the credits.
Yes, that was awesome.
That was pretty cool. And the score in general for this movie is actually pretty good as well. But I just liked hearing the classic theme. Like it's the thing I remember most about the original movie. It's just like bum 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 bum.
It's a very iconic theme.
Yeah. But anyway, other spoilers, death scenes in this movie. I thought Chris Pratt had a great death scene. In this movie in which he blows everyone up. It's a fun time.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out there was a nice homage around that scene to Seven Samurai, where the guy with the Gatling gun had an eye patch, and like he calls him the One-Eyed Jack and all that stuff. In Seven Samurai, the bandit leader has an eye patch.
Oh, well, there you go.
I thought that was a cool little thing they did there.
Neat. Very cool. I also very much liked Vincent D'Onofrio's death scene. I thought that was very effective. He's the first one in the group to die, I believe, right?
Yes, he is, yeah.
So in the end, four of the seven die, which I believe is the same as the original movie, although it's different character analogs who die. The characters they play in this movie are not the same characters that they play in the original movie. Like, they have different names, but they're also exactly the same.
right, yeah.
So, like, Chris Pratt's character is the Steve McQueen role, Denzel Washington's character is the Yul Brynner role. Who was it? I think Ethan Hawke was in the James Coburn role. Was James Coburn the one who was good with knives? Because that might have been Lee Byung-hun.
I don't remember.
In any case, they all kind of slot into the similar roles as the characters in the original Magnificent Seven. And I think four or five of the characters in the original movie die. And so four characters die in this movie. It's Chris Pratt, Vincent D'Onofrio, the Mexican character, and Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke's character.
Right.
Does Byung-hun Lee die?
Yes, he does, yeah.
Okay, so maybe the Mexican guy lives and Byung-hun died.
Yeah, it's Red Harvest, the Mexican guy, and Denzel Washington's character.
Right. And I thought the death scenes were pretty effective and solid across the board. I very much like Ethan Hawke's arc, as I mentioned before, where he's kind of this acclaimed sharpshooter, and he's trying to live that up to that legend, but at the same time he's going blind. Right? That was his issue.
I thought it was PTSD. Because during the first shootout, he's like panicking. And you could see he refuses to shoot anyone, that type of thing. And then at the end, he gets challenged and he rises up and overcomes it and then murders a ton of people.
Yeah, so he overcomes his issues in any case. And you know, it's a nice way for him to go out, and then he dies along with his buddy, Byung-hun.
I did have one continuity issue, I think, maybe, with Ethan Hawke's character.
Yeah.
So after the first shootout, we're shown that he's got blood dripping down his hand, and then we see him put like a handkerchief or something like that under his jacket pocket on his shoulder, and he's like clearly in a lot of pain.
Right.
And then it never comes up again, and no one ever talks about it, and people slap him on the shoulder and grab his shoulders, and like it just goes away. And like, yeah. did they forget about it? Like, it was really weird.
That's true. That is true. Denzel Washington's arc, how did you think that played out in the movie, Mike?
I thought that was a thing I was not expecting, the reveal that Peter Sarsgaard's character had killed his family and hung him as well, and he survived.
Right.
Or hanged, excuse me. That's what I was talking about. It kind of calls into question. We're led to believe for most of the movie that he's doing this out of honor and duty to protect these people and justice and stand up for the little guy in the town. And then we're shown that it's actually just a revenge plot for him to get a chance to kill the people that killed his family.
Right. And so I do like that Haley Bennett's actually the one who kills him towards the end as well. That was very effective. Like as Denzel Washington's like about to take his revenge.
Yeah.
It's like in the middle of torturing Peter Sarsgaard's character, Haley Bennett just kind of comes in and shoots him. And that's the end of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was a really interesting way to add some of, you know, some Snyder, a sprinkle of Snyderverse, I guess, into this story.
Anytime anything is remotely dark, a sprinkle of Snyderverse. I did think the voiceover at the end was incredibly clunky. I thought that was very bad.
As well as the CGI shot at the very end. Like, you couldn't make forced wood crosses. You had to make them CGI. Like, it was really weird.
It was a very clunky ending, I thought. The voiceover, though, man, it was like... It reminded me of the end of the Fantastic Four remake, where it's, they're gazing longingly and they're like, there's something kind of fantastic about this. And like, what did you say? I think we just came up with our team name. and this has the Haley Bennett doing the voiceover, and it's like, I suppose they truly were the Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
I mean, not exactly like that, but she says something along the lines of,
I suppose it was very magnificent or something like that. And like, really?
Yeah. Like, what are we, some kind of Magnificent Seven?
I believe that, like me, these seven people.
That was a more obscure reference. That was a Point Break reference.
You're welcome,
Point
everyone.
Break remake reference.
But
the only people still talking about the Point Break remake.
Oh, man. Yeah, but those last final minute or whatever was very weird and felt like they didn't know what to do. So they were like, just make a CG thing and write voiceover for her.
Yeah, just tack something on at the end, make it seem kind of uplifting.
Right.
Even though it's kind of a downer ending.
It is. It is a very downer ending.
But they kind of like package it to make it seem uplifting. It doesn't really work. But in any case, are there any other spoilery things you want to talk about, Mike? Or is that about wrap it up?
I think that's pretty much it. I thought this was a fun... I guess it goes on a little long. I don't know.
I would say it goes on a little long, yeah. I feel like it's paced a little slowly, especially at the beginning. It's kind of like... it's this weird circular thing. All right, so...
All right, lay it out for us, Mike.
The beginning of this movie kind of reminded me of the first like 45 minutes of The Avengers, where, in the first few minutes of The Avengers, it's like... different scenes of them recruiting different members of the team, right? So you have the scene of like Coulson going to Tony Stark, you have the scene of Nick Fury going to Captain America, you got the scene of Black Widow going to Hulk, and they're slowly kind of building the team up over the course of 45 minutes, which is what this one kind of does as well.
Yeah.
But the original Magnificent Seven directly influenced the first Avengers comic. Like, the Avengers comic was taken from the Magnificent Seven. Like, that was the idea.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. That's awesome.
And so it's this weird circular thing where, like, the remake of Magnificent Seven reminded me of the Avengers movie, which was adapted from the Avengers comic, which was taken from the original Magnificent Seven. And it's, like, which was a remake of Seven Samurai, which is a remake of the Immortal Bards, what have you. I'm making that part up, but still.
Yeah.
So, weird circular logic going there. Pretty wild.
Yeah.
In any case... I thought the movie was like overall solid. I enjoyed it. It doesn't replace the original for me in any capacity, but it's an enjoyable time at the movies. Mike?
Yeah, I think it is. It's also a fun comparison. If you can sit through the 3.5 hours of Seven Samurai, it is a fun comparison to see what the updates are and how they changed it and a lot of the same story beats and stuff. And it's interesting just to watch Kurosawa's direction in, you know.
Right. I mean, let's be real. Seven Samurai is the best version of any of these.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty great. If you can handle the 3.5 hours.
Right. It is pretty awesome. But in any case, that about wraps it up for this week, Mike. So where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, which we talked about for real this time, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
Yeah, I mentioned to you off the air that I played about a half hour of Dungeons & Dragons the other day.
You did the thing.
I did the thing that you do.
Yeah. And to be honest, while I was watching Seven Samurai, I was like, this would make an awesome D&D adventure. Because have that's to come together, protect a town from bandits.
Because that's the way your mind works now. It just filters through D&D.
Everything is D&D for me.
All right, and you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of my stuff at filmbook.com as well. And I'll be covering New York Comic Con this week, so definitely check that out, all my coverage and stuff. Thank you for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DeCrescio. If you're listening to this review via a podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and take a moment to give us a review. And also, you can subscribe to Film Book's Patreon campaign. You can donate, do whatever stuff at filmbook.com/Patreon or patreon.com/filmbook. I mixed that up. patreon.com/filmbook. Go do that. Any and all feedback, compliments, and topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. You can please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce just so many different ones how to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now join us next week for a special Film Bookcast where we'll be discussing my experience at New York Comic Con. So I'm pretty excited about that, Mike. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I'm excited to wear the host hat for one episode again.
Yes,
you should be fun.
Yes, you hosted the podcast last year when we did the New York Comic Con podcast, and you did a great job, Mike. I have full confidence in your abilities.
Thanks.
This time around. And then you can check out our next complete works, in which we're going to be talking about Nicolas Cage's role in Michael Bay's The Rock. So I'm pretty stoked about that one. I just rewatched the trailer for The Rock on YouTube.
What?
Just to get me psyched up, man. It is, oh. And it is a classic 90s overblown action movie trailer.
All right, I'm gonna have to go watch that as soon as we're done.
It is, you know, it's, you know, the voiceover guy going like, Michael Bay is The Rock, Nicolas Cage, Sean Connery. I'm pretty excited to talk about The Rock when we get to that. But New York Comic Con podcast is next, so definitely check that out when we get to it. Thank you guys so much for listening. We are out.